Jesse Corcoran Podcast.
And how do you like this situation? The tying and possible winning runs are in scoring position with two out and Jack Clark coming up. The Herzog and his partner, Red Shandings, meanwhile, in reading, was sort of talking about walking and pitch to that blank Van Slyke. That's what he just muttered in the dugout. Now, I think it was a rhetorical question. Do I walk him and pitch to that so-and-so? He's not going to walk him. It is Jack Clark and Tom Niedenfuhr going head-to-head, and the ballgame on the line and the crowd on its feet. One way or another, what a way to end. And he hits one to deep left field, and that one is gone. And Lasorda got the answer to his rhetorical question. Something about, should I walk this guy and pitch to that so-and-so? Well, he didn't walk him.
Look where all the players are. They want to make sure he touches home plate. Now they'll pick him up. They all backed off. That was a rule they made after Ozzie Smith at the home run. There was some indecision as to whether he had touched home plate, so Daniel made sure.
Look at who was out there at home plate, Vince Coleman.
Oh,
number 29.
Everybody's going to be out there.
You would think that the face would be a little kinder to one man in such a short amount of time.
That's as slow a trip as Jack Clark ever made. I mean, he takes a lot of time.
There's McGee.
Look at Socia just kneeling in disbelief.
Here's the shot, and you see it go, and you see you just kind of toss the bat. The next thing you see is the camera opening up wide, and then you see Pedro Guerrero take his glove and throw it down, and you see the scramble in the crowd. Now, they're showing the scramble in the crowd, and when they cut back to you, you're rounding first. It's like this man is enjoying this, I think.
I had played long enough at that time to realize and know that basically at that point, Tommy Lasorda was trying to show me up.
Mm.
Okay, and you shouldn't do that. And not just to me, but to anybody.
Don't do that to a guy
really,
with a bat
in his
hand.
Whitey wouldn't do it. You don't do that. You know what I mean? And that's really, you know, the Dodger Lasorda ego type thing right there. And so I was emotional then because I hit it, but I was also like, take that, you know, you want to play this little game, you know, so I'm going to take my time around here and just show you how stupid a move that was.
And after something like that, Jack, how long does it take you to come down? Can you go back to the hotel room at that point and have a meal and lay down, get a nap, and then go out? Or are you just on such an emotional high that literally until you get to the game the next day, you're still flying?
You know what, to be honest with you, JC, to me it was just another hit that helped us win a game, and because to me it wasn't over with yet. We still had games to play, and I didn't want to get too high and act like, well, now that we did that, the season was over and we accomplished what we wanted. We hadn't finished our job yet. You know, we had a long way still to go, and it was nice to that happened, but, you know, we still had games to play, and I was already starting to think about the pitchers for Kansas City and who I was going to be facing and what they were going to be throwing and starting to focus. I remember getting on the plane and the bus, and it was great when I got back to St. Louis early morning. There was a lot of people at the airport. I never forget, one of my most memorable moments was when I went home.
Oh, your whole neighborhood, all your neighbors were out. I remember hearing you talk about that.
I remember leaving the airport, and just tremendous crowd, and they took us from the airport to try to get away from it and bus us out because everybody's tired, and it was early in the morning. And I remember the crowd, but driving home, it was early in the morning, 3 o'clock, and there was no traffic, and it was nice and quiet and dark. But when we turned down our street, the whole neighborhood was out there with all the little kids, little babies at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And they had the whole street lined up all the way down with candles. And it just was, I thought it was someone from, it was like from outer space looking from a distance, like, what is going on here? You know, and everybody was out there when we got down by our street. And, you know, they didn't stop us. They didn't bother us or anything. They just kind of waved to us and we stopped and said hello. And it was just really, that was something that me and my family, it was very special to see. Because that was really St. Louis showing its love for the Cardinals and for me and my family, and that was very important to me.
And that's baseball, folks. That's baseball right there.
Now I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous. Don't be rocky.
You're a teenage guest is jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again.
This is the day we've been waiting for. JC here at jcontheline.com. I thought you'd enjoy hearing that Jack Clark story again, along with the actual play-by-play from NBC with Joe Garagiola and Vin Scully sitting there doing the call, and Tommy Lasorda and like Andy Van Slyke, and so it goes, and off to the World Series it was. We were in loge boxes at Chavez Ravine Dodger Stadium for that game. The U-Man and I and a couple of other people from the station went out there. We are broadcasting live from the Cardinals Hotel, and what a great time it was. And we flew back victorious. Then it was off to Kansas City with a whole different story, but why bring that up on an otherwise promising Wednesday morning? Dodgers do not have a good playoff record against our St. Louis Cardinals, so let the game, I would say games, but in this case it's one, let the game begin. Red Sox beat the Yankees 6-2. Yankees were never in it last night in the American League wild card game, so off to Tampa they go. Pretty good football game on tonight with the Rams and Seattle, but I don't know a lot of people who are going to be bothering with that. This is that time of year, if you live up in Minnesota, where the weather starts changing early. If you're watching that game from Fenway last night, people were bundled up. It was chilly out there last night. Minneapolis is a beautiful town. It really is pretty. And you got that Land of a Thousand Lakes thing going on up there. And it was many, many years ago, but I was on a boat, like one of these two-decker party boats on Lake Minnetonka. And you're just floating around on a beautiful summer evening, seeing the sights, all the rich people with their homes right on the water. And you say to yourself, gosh, this is beautiful. What about moving here someday? It really is that pretty. It'll actually make you think to yourself, maybe we should move here. And then you remember, oh, that's right. Summer here is 3 weeks long. And like they say in Wisconsin, don't move here and then complain about the weather, okay? Because the weather is cold most of the time. So don't come here and then bitch about it. Find something you like to do outside in the cold, whether it's ice fishing or ice skating or snowmobiling or whatever it is. Find something you like to do outside and then enjoy doing it, but don't you dare move here and then bitch about the weather. That's their attitude up there. 16 years ago today, the year was 2005, and members of the Minnesota Vikings rented two party boats to set sail on the aforementioned Lake Minnetonka, where they allegedly engaged in highly sexual acts. This was the difference between their party boat and mine. They had women, they had the crew members, you know, because there's a staff that works these boats. This is a huge boat. And they got a staff member. You got a chef and a bartender and servers and stuff like that. It's almost like floating on a small restaurant, okay? Or going to an event where you know, the place, is, the whole thing is being catered, all right? Four players, Dante Culpepper, Bryant McKinney, Fred Smoot, and Mo Williams, were charged with indecent conduct, disorderly conduct, lewd or lascivious conduct. It took 2 months for them to file the charges. All of this, by the way, going on in front of those crew members. Charges against the Vikings, including quarterback Dante Culpepper, eventually dropped. Williams was found guilty of disorderly conduct, but cleared of two other charges. Smoot and McKinney took a plea deal and pled guilty to disorderly conduct charges. They were sentenced to 48 hours of community service and fined $1,000 each. They were also fined by the NFL for their part in the scandal, but they weren't suspended. My guess is, based on stories I've heard in the aftermath of this whole thing, the answer is, damned right we'd do it again. Many of you will remember that back in the 80s when we were doing the old Breakfast Club on Classic Rock 93.7 KSD, back in those old days, the announcer for David Letterman at the time was a guy by the name of Bill Wendell. And I would send scripts to Bill Wendell. He would record, well, I sent scripts with a $1,000 check along with it. And he would record these things that were spinoffs of the introductions they do on the show back then. So it was from St. Louis, and you hear the actual Bill Wendell. From St. Louis, number one in illegal cable hookups, it's JC and the Breakfast Club. It would go on like that. And he would record that stuff for me and then send the tape back, and I would produce it and make it sound like the opening to David Letterman show. It was just some fun thing that we did. And then Bill Wendell retired, and then soon after that, a guy by the name of Alan Coulter came along, otherwise known as Big Red from time to time. And Alan Coulter really added a completely new dimension to the show because he was a classically trained actor. He was a lawyer. He went to law school. He was a teacher. He did tons and tons of voiceover work. And when the opening popped up, when Bill Wendell retired, they listened to only one tape. They loved Alan Coulter. And he was with the show for, I don't know, something like 17 years. It was a real, real long time. You know, it was 5 or 6 years ago that David Letterman said, I'm retiring too. And so everybody went away. And about a year ago, I thought to myself, hey, you know, it would be fun. Go back and recapture those moments from the 80s. Do the new David Letterman theme. And I'll put together the same arrangement for Alan Coulter. I'll send him a check. I'll send him the scripts. He records them, and everybody goes away happy. So I found, tracked him down through a friend, my friend who used to be a writer for Dave, and tracked him down, and we had a lovely phone call. First time I'd ever talked to the guy, but we had a really, really nice phone call. But he said, I'm going to turn it down. I was like, really? He goes, yeah, I'm going to turn it down. And he didn't give any explanation for it, but we had a wonderful talk. He couldn't have been nicer. And I hung up the phone and I was like, well, I'm a little upset. I'm a little disappointed, obviously, that we're not going to get him to do it. Well, as you heard a couple of days ago, Alan Coulter passed away. I think he was 77. And now it makes me wonder if he knew that the end was near. And that was one of the reasons he turned it down, because it was inexplicable. Why would you just turn down the kind of opportunity I threw at him? And now I'm thinking to myself, yeah, we don't know. Nobody has said anything about the cause of death or anything like that. But I'm just going to bet you that this was something that he had been battling for a while. He knew he was sick. He probably knew he didn't have a lot of time left. That probably was the main factor in his choice to turn down the opportunity. But he was a really, really nice guy, incredibly talented. And Alan Coulter has moved on to the great beyond. Well, this happens about twice a year. There are two organizations. One is just a website, and the other one is actual government statistics. But it happens twice a year, about 6 months apart, where somebody steps forward and says, hey, we put together a list of the least safe cities in America. And guess what, St. Louis? In this particular case, it was Wallet Hub. They put out their annual list of the safest cities in America, based on everything from crime and traffic accidents to financial safety and natural disasters. And cities in the Northeast did well this year. The safest city in America, Columbia, Maryland. That's about halfway between Baltimore and D.C. I've been there, and it's might be safe, but there ain't anything else going on there. The rest of the top 10, South Burlington, Vermont. That's where Amy Poehler is from. Nashua, New Hampshire, which is where I believe that's where Chris Carpenter was from. If it's not Nashua, it's someplace really close. Yonkers, New York. Madison, Wisconsin, where the ratio is 3 women to every man. Portland, Maine. Warwick, Rhode Island. Raleigh, North Carolina. Burlington, Vermont. And Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I almost took a job there back in the 70s. Of the 182 cities they looked at, guess who came in last place for safety? Yeah, right behind Fort Lauderdale and San Bernardino, California. Tell everyone you know, everywhere you go, I'm sold on St. Louis. I'm sold. By the way, America's 5 biggest cities didn't rank high either. New York, 99th. L.A., 168. Chicago, 114. Houston, 148. Phoenix, 109. Kacey Musgraves' publicist confirmed that she did perform naked on Saturday Night Live last weekend, and that the audience didn't see anything during setup because she was blocked by a sheet Also, it was the show's first nude appearance, in case you missed it. She was sitting on a stool with her legs crossed, and her body was blocked by her guitar and strap. The lighting was low. She was filmed in just only from the front, so nobody saw anything, but she was still out there in the buff, and that ain't bad because she's a handsome female, in addition to a good singer. I'm not into the country stuff, but you can watch with the sound down. Nothing wrong with that. All right, late night tonight, Jimmy Fallon's got Anthony Anderson, Daniel Craig, that would be James Bond, on with Kimmel, Brett Baer, and Susie Essman from Curb, Your Enthusiasm, on with Colbert, James Corden is Judy Greer, Blake Shelton on with Seth Meyers, Trevor Noah is going to take a stab at Monica Lewinsky. The new Venom movie cut a scene where Woody, this is going to be in the movie, it's not going to be there. It's a scene where Woody Harrelson's character French kissed someone to death. That is some powerful tongue and jaw power going on. Ringo, along with 100 other drummers, including Max Weinberg, made a cover of Come Together for charity. You'll be hearing about that very soon. He was on with, I think it was Colbert. Was it Colbert? I'm pretty sure it was Colbert. And they said, what's your favorite Beatles song? And he said, Come Together. And it sort of, people sort of looked like, huh, wonder why. And then Ringo just paused for a moment. He says, you know, just because of the way John was that day. And he didn't really elaborate, but something happened during the recording of Come Together that really stuck in Ringo's mind all these years. All right, birthdays today. Elizabeth Shue from Leaving Las Vegas, 58. Tony Dungy, Sunday Night Football, former head coach of the Indianapolis Colts, 66. Kevin Cronin of REO, 70 today. Britt Eklund, she was a Bond girl back in the day. And, of course, Rod Stewart sang about her. I'm sure it was a good night for him when he came home that night and said, hey, honey, guess what? I wrote this song. You're going to be a big hit. We need you to do a little groaning at the end of the record. Can you do that for me? Speaking of which, 1969 on this date, the Beatles for the first time released a George Harrison song as the A side of a Beatles single. It was Something. It went on to number one. Lennon and McCartney's Come Together was on the flip side. It went number one a month later. Elizabeth Taylor got married for the eighth time on this date in 1991. Larry Fortensky, who she met him in rehab. This was the date of the Anita Hill public testimony on the Clarence Thomas thing. And another singing show. Another one. This one's called Alter Ego. Going to be on Fox. Five contestants compete for the final audition. Alanis Morissette is one of the judges on the show. I like her. And we lost this guy a year ago today. That, of course, the Eddie Van Halen solo on Michael Jackson's song, Beat It. When you hear it isolated like that, it doesn't even sound like what was in the song. You really need the Beat It song behind you, hearing that for the guitar solo to really make a lot of sense. But when you listen to it isolated, you hear everything that's going on in the whole thing. Yeah, but Eddie Van Halen checked out 1 year ago today. I have two Van Halen stories. One goes all the way back to 1982, and I was working at Howard Stern's radio station, DC-101, in the nation's capital, and we did so much merchandising and stuff. For every concert, we had T-shirts, and we had little buttons and pins, and you know, we'd be out in the parking lot of the arena before the concert giving the stuff away, and people would come in wearing all this DC-101 stuff. It was just great and so demoralizing to our competitors. It was fantastic. Smash and I would be out there in the parking lot sometimes, you know, just working the crowd. And when you go backstage, especially, you know, you're talking early 80s, it was almost the 70s. Think about that for a minute, where all of that backstage stuff was always going around, some of it legendary, depending on the band and the venue and stuff like that. And you'd go to these concerts and we'd be backstage because we were the radio guys, and you would see all this stuff going on. You'd see some people you knew. You would see a lot of people you had no idea who they were. Yes, a lot of chicks, semi-clad, as the case may be. I'd been to, you know, a couple of dozen of these things in Washington, D.C. at various venues. And then Van Halen comes to town. And I go backstage before the beginning of this show thinking, oh, my God, this is going to be an absolute circus back there. Go back there. Nobody. I mean, no. I mean, the band, the roadies and the managers, and me. And that was it. I mean, there was practically a tumbleweed blowing through the backstage area. And I was like, what is this? What is this? And then you realize, well, they do all their partying after the show. Entire floors of luxury hotels occupied by the band and the hangers on the riffraff. But the strangest backstage environment I'd ever seen. And oh, by the way, that was when I saw them pouring iced tea into empty whiskey bottles to take on stage. All those years you watched Van Halen, you know, drinking whiskey right out of the bottle on stage during the show. Sorry to burst your bubble. They were taking the Nest Tea plunge. But when you stop to think about it, you figure they're on stage almost every night. You can't drink an entire bottle of whiskey every single night at every single show. One of the people we had on the air a couple of years back is somebody that knew Eddie Van Halen as well as anybody. And she was pretty forthcoming about it, too. We were, of course, talking about Valerie Bertinelli. I apologize to people who heard this because a couple of months ago is her birthday, and I think I played a segment from this interview. But it's still very interesting to hear about the life of Eddie Van Halen, particularly away from the stage, from somebody who was married to him for very many years.
You were friends with some sort of disc jockey in Shreveport or something, and you were basically hanging around backstage with your hooks out at a... at a Van Halen concert, and what do you think made your presence different from the thousands and thousands of women that had positioned themselves backstage in something sexy, and yet you got to him and those other people did not?
Oh, God. I have no idea. Maybe
come on. Come on. Do you remember what you were wearing?
I remember I was wearing thigh-high boots. I do remember that.
Thigh-high boots. Hold on. Just stop there. I want to think about that for a moment.
Oh, gosh.
Wow. All right. And do you remember what your first words were with Eddie?
Hi.
From him or from you? Was that you or him?
Hi, I'm Valerie.
What happened next?
God, you know what? This is 28 years ago this happened. I met him. That's a long time ago. And I can't say that I was totally sober, so... if you're going back and I'm trying to, you know, pick my brain. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just remember his smile, basically.
And he smiled, and you smiled, and the rest is history. And
yeah, there you go.
It was that wild thing. Now, we had you on the air, I don't know, it was probably like 10, 12 years ago or something like that. It was right about the time that one of the tabloid shows, I think it was Hard Copy, had put pictures on the air of Eddie clearly in the throes of an embrace in some woman's apartment. And I asked you about it.
No, it was actually at our house, I think.
Oh, is that your home? It's even better.
Yeah.
So at the time, I was asking you about it, going, well, what are they trying to do? How did they do this? And you completely... Were you just in denial at that time?
You think?
Dumb question, Jay-Z.
No, total denial. And plus, I mean, I was still trying to make the marriage work, but it was clearly not working. So, but we had a young child, and I thought, well, I can't not let this work now. I mean, I should have left years ago, but, you know, now I have a baby. I can't leave. But that's the way my brain thought back then, but not any longer.
With all the stuff... living in the public arena and the things that the tabloids and the tabloid TV shows and everything were writing about you guys and publishing about you guys, do you think that this marriage would have worked had you two been in some other profession?
No. No, I think we loved each other and still do love each other immensely. But we have too many other issues going on in our lives where it makes it too difficult for us to live in the same house together. You know, and I mean, I really do love him like a brother. He's a sweetheart, but I just can't live with him. And he would say the same thing about me.
And this life that you had with Eddie seemed like it was quite a bit different from the life you had growing up. Your dad was a General Motors executive. I know that you were born in Delaware, and you sort of moved all over the country, Michigan, Shreveport, places like that. Mm-hmm. What did your mother and father think of this relationship early on, and did that change over the course of time?
Well, they were able to separate Ed from the job that he did, and they loved Ed because he really is such a kind man when, you know, he's sober. But what his job is sometimes it might define who he is, or he might let it, but that isn't who he is. He's really so much more than that, even though he happens to be, you know, the greatest guitar player ever. But he also is so much more than that.
Yeah.
They loved him. They loved Ed. They didn't love the guitar player. They loved Ed.
And when Eddie died a year ago, Valerie Bertinelli issued a series of statements that proved to me that she was still very, very much in love with Eddie Van Halen. And it was just one of those things. You know, I think we've all had these sort of toxic relationships where you love somebody and you can't be with them. You just drive each other crazy. The electricity that exists between two human beings, the electricity that brought them together, sometimes can be the same kind of energy that actually affects a relationship in a negative way. Who knows? And it's like I always say, we have a house in Florida. We bounce back and forth between Florida and St. Louis, the land of Disney, Orlando, Florida. And I've always said that there's a huge similarity between Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and Viagra. Seriously, stop and think about it. Both cases, you have to wait around for an hour for a two-minute ride. Good morning, everybody. And with that, we say thanks for listening to the J.C. Corcoran podcast here for Wednesday. We're here every morning, absolutely free. 7 to 7:30 is when we post. 7 o'clock Central is when we post. If you miss a podcast, go back and pick them up. We archive them all. Email me at jc@jconline.com. Facebook is The Showgram with J.C. Corcoran. Go Cards! Think about it, 24 hours from now, we are either going to be in a great mood or a not-so-great mood. Here's hoping Jack Clark can send some of his energy to the West Coast tonight out at Dodger Stadium. All right, that's it. We've beaten this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.
The J.C. Corcoran Podcast.